professor at the University of Missouri, working on three large USDA grants, actually four simultaneously. But what I'm going to, and bits of that are going to kind of feed into this talk as we go through. Feed efficiency is a USDA-funded grant. HEPA fertility is a USDA-funded grant. They're large grants, and they involve teams of individuals from multiple institutions, and they have extension and teaching components to them. They're not all just research components. This is the website, so if you happen to have a pencil and pen and you want to go and get some information on this particular feed efficiency grant, that's the place to go and do it. There's all sorts of interesting publications that are located on this website. There's also tools like RFI calculators that you can download and compute RFI if you're actually feeding cattle yourself and collecting data. Number of participants that are involved in this grant, and it includes both nutritionists and geneticists and extension personnel at multiple universities. And there are 17 investigators at 9 institutions that are currently involved. And we're also partnered with GeneSeq on this. I'll tell you everything, all of the objectives. I'm just going to focus in on a couple of the research-oriented objectives. And those that apply primarily to improvement of feed efficiency through the genetic applications. So what we said we were going to do was assemble populations of animals that had feed intake and growth data, and hopefully also ultrasound or slaughter data on up to 8,000 individuals representing 8 of the major breeds in the US, and that we would collect DNA samples on all of those individuals. We would then have enough money to genotype about 2,400 of those individuals. 2,000 of them were legacy individuals that had already been collected at the University of Missouri and at Illinois. Those animals had already been genotyped, so we were starting off with 2,000 of these animals already collected, already genotyped. And we were going to add another 2,400 to those. We said we would use the HD assay, and we did to an extent, but as we got rolling into this project, it became more and more clear that the important thing to do was to genotype more and more of these animals. And so we changed to a lower density platform, the 50K at that time, so that we could get more of these animals genotyped. These data are being used for a number of different purposes. So first of all, development of molecular breeding values, and Dorian just gave us a great talk about that. And that work was led by Dorian and Marty Sachi, who's also here in the audience. We were doing genome-wide association analysis, looking for genes of large effect that underlie these QTLs, because there's now a lot of movement worldwide to try and identify these causal variants, the variants that explain at least 1% of the genetic variants in traits. Because if you can get them identified, it's then possible to compute molecular breeding values that have modest accuracies regardless of what you know about the animal's breed type or pedigree. You can genotype those animals, come up with an estimate of feed efficiency that's based upon these large effect genes. And then we're going to do fine mapping, and we've actually changed the way that we were going to go about doing that. In other words, to try and identify these causal variants, the traditional approach is to sort of look at the reference sequence, try to figure out what other variants exist in that region, and then genotype those and try to whittle in statistically to identify what could be the causal variant that directly has the effect on the trait. That's kind of all changed. There's a new paradigm. There's several new paradigms that are coming along, and I'll talk about both of those as we get into it. But talk a little more worldwide, and I think Dorian, there he is, told me the other day there's at least 3,000 animals now that have been sequenced worldwide. The Thousand Bull Project is a project that's leading the analysis and consolidation of those data, and I think about 1,800 of those animals are now in that project. We're just working on run 4, where there are 1,147 bulls, primarily bulls that have been sequenced. At the University of Missouri, we've done another 257, and I'll talk about that as we get down it. And then finally, a little bit up here at the USDA, at Clay Center, Harvey Frinkley was working on looking at methane production and the rumen microbiome. Hands up if you know that word microbiome. Have you heard of that word before? Okay, few of you have heard that word before. What it means is most of you are aware that we don't live alone, right? So inside of us, in our stomachs, and in various other places, like in our nostrils and in our lungs, there's lots and lots of bugs that live in there. And they do in cattle as well. And those bugs, in fact, have more genes in them than do cows themselves. So the number of different species, there are hundreds of species of bacteria that live inside of us and that live inside of cattle. And they can differ in both their species, or they can differ in the proportion of individuals from different species. And what that means is that there is probably more genetic variance inside of humans than there is in the human genome sequence itself, and ditto in cattle. We are more complicated than just the DNA that we find in our cells. We are also complicated by the DNA that's present in the bacteria that live along with us. And so that's a very interesting and emerging area of research. And Harvey's done some work, published a couple of papers, and I'll mention that briefly. So kind of where are we at? So turns out, this is a really complicated slide. You can't see it because it's too small, but it kind of shows a couple of things. Number one, it shows that we pretty much got the 8, in fact more than that, 10 of the most important numerically breeds in the United States represented in this data set, but they don't exist as purebreds. Just as Dorian was saying, that the majority of Simmentals that are getting registered are not 100% purebred Simmentals. Same thing in this data set. We have reasonably small groups of purebred animals. We have some purebred Herefords, we have some purebred Limousines, some purebred Angus represented in this data set, but the majority of these are represented within the industry. The good news is, if this, the bottom of this column down here indicates, we have 7,700 animals in this collection that we have feed intake data, we have growth data on them, and we've genotyped them. And we've now just collected another 1,200 animals in this last year that have not been genotyped yet. And in the final year of the project, which just started on April 1st, we're probably going to collect about another 2,000 individuals. So we'll end up with about 3,000 more individuals than the 8,000 that we've already got complete data on by the end of this project. And as I'll tell you in a minute, we're going to genotype these animals too. We figured out a way to get some money, wrote a new grant, we're building a new genotyping platform, and we're going to genotype these individuals with that platform. So quite a remarkable data set. By the time we get this done, you know, we will have data on probably close to 9 or 10,000 animals that we have intake data on. So methane, what's the story with methane? Very simple story with methane. If you take high RFI animals and low RFI animals, so high efficiency and low efficiency animals, and you compare them on a per dry matter intake basis, they have the same efficiency. They produce the same amount, of methane. Same amount of methane on a dry matter intake. So given the food that they're eating, they're producing the same amount of methane from the food that they're eating. But efficient animals grow faster. They grow better, right, with that same amount of food. So if you're eating 25 pounds of dry matter per day and you're a high efficiency animal, it means you're gaining a lot more than an animal that's eating 25 pounds on a dry matter basis and is an inefficient animal. It's growing at 3 pounds per day as opposed to 4 pounds per day. So what that means is, on a per unit of beef production basis, efficient animals produce less methane. But they're doing it, they produce the same amount of methane for each pound of food that they're eating, right? Just to get to the end when they're slaughtered, they eat less, and so they produce less total methane. So there is reduction in methane production when you look at it from a per pound of beef produced, but not on an intake production. The microbiota story is also an interesting story. This is, again, Harvey's work, and what they found at USDA was that the bugs that are in the rumen of these animals are sentient, but what differs about them is the relative proportion of the different species. There are dozens of species of microbes that live in our guts and live in the guts of cattle, and the relative proportion of each of those species differs between high efficiency and low efficiency animals. Now, does that directly cause differences in efficiency, or is it simply a function of the fact that these animals are more efficient? We don't know the answer to that. But there's work that's been done in humans that indicates that humans that have different populations inside them are more susceptible or less susceptible to things like obesity. So there's also evidence in mice that the host's genome actually can control the structure of that population. In other words, it's our genes that are imposing an environment within our gut that dictates what the proportion of those species are. So, interesting nevertheless. Okay, so Marty published a paper about 4 months ago now. No, it's June, isn't it? It's 8 months ago. About 8 months ago now, that's shown right down the bottom there, that was the very first analysis that we did of the first sets of data. We had four different breed groups represented, and in total there was a little over 5,000 animals represented in this analysis. And what we were interested in doing was understanding what heritability was for these traits in the different breed groups, understanding whether or not there were genes that had large effect on these different phenotypes, and understanding whether we could build reasonably accurate molecular breeding values from these data sets. And so Marty did this analysis, and we came up with some very interesting results of it. You probably can't see everything here. This is dry matter intake. Here are the different breed groups. Metabolic midweight, average daily gain, that measures that go into the calculation of efficiency, and residual feed intake over here. Heritability are in these columns here, and if you can't see them, I will just indicate that these heritabilities are all moderate to fairly large. And the best data set that we had in here was the Hereford data set. And when I say best, I mean because the heritabilities were almost uniformly higher in the Hereford data set than in the other data sets. And that doesn't mean that Herefords are genetically different to the other breed types. It means that Doug Olson really knows how to feed animals, and he doesn't do what we do at universities, which is put these animals in a gross ape system, and then our nutritionists come in and put 36 different levels of treatment on top of it, of everything. So they come in and see whether adding on, using these animals. Doug Olson doesn't do that. He feeds them to get them to grow, and he does a great job of it. He doesn't superimpose any other treatments on top, which is what we do at universities. We have to. And what that means is we end up with like 100 contemporary groups in some of these samples. And Doug Olson ends up with one contemporary group every time he feeds these animals. But nevertheless, the heritabilities are very substantial. What is interesting is some of these variances differ quite a lot. The genetic variance differs quite a lot between these different breed groups. And it's not really clear whether or not that means that there is truly different genetic variances within different populations of cattle, but it does have some downstream consequences for how we try to analyze these data. It makes things a little bit more difficult from that perspective. Okay, what this is one version of something called a Manhattan plot. And what it represents, and I'll show you two or three of these. Fortunately, I'm not going to show you any mixed model equations or inverses or anything like that, but I will show you my equivalent of that. And this is my equivalent. This is basically something called a Manhattan plot, and these were generated by Marty and Dorian, and they used the tools that Dorian was talking about to estimate these things. And what they represent is, on this axis right here, is the genome. So every one of these little colored bars you see represents a different chromosome, and every one of these little dots that you can see represents a marker, a SNP marker that we genotyped in these animals. And there are about, in every one of these populations, there are about 600,000 of those represented in these populations. And on this axis up here, you're really asking the question, how big an effect is that marker detecting? And so you can see, for example, those two points right there are two of the largest ones that we found in this analysis. and it says over here on chromosome, not quite sure which one that is, that's probably 7, right, at 93. No, at 23, I think, 7 at 23. There is, so on chromosome 7 and 23 million bases down that chromosome, there is a SNP that's detecting something in the genome that is putatively explaining 10% of the genetic variance in dry matter intake in Angus animals. And that's remarkable. That's remarkably large. We're not sure we trust it. We're not sure we believe it because it's too big. It's really big. This is typically what you see in these kinds of analyses. This is in herfords. This is also dry matter intake. And this is about 4%, but it actually happens to be on a different chromosome. And one of the things that we observe from these analyses is that when we compare the results of an analysis, that there are genes that have large effect, they're different across these different breeds. They're in general different. There is some commonality, but in general they're different. And that's what this table shows. This table shows Angus are in this row here, Herefords are in this row here, Simmentals, and this is composite population from the USDA. First column's dry matter intake, mid-test metabolic weight, gain on test, residual feed intake. And what these entries are the 10 largest effects that we found in the genome for that particular analysis. So for example, in Angus, chromosome 7, 23 million bases down the chromosome, we found evidence that there's some variant in the genome of Angus cattle that causes a 10% variance, explains 10% of the additive genetic variance in dry matter intake. And what we've done here is put little boxes around the ones that tend to be, that are common. So at 20 million bases, chromosome 20 at 4 million bases, turns up here, turns up here, probably the same one there, definitely the same one there. So influencing multiple traits in different breeds of cattle, but these are pretty much the only ones that we found in common. They don't look like they're all the same across breeds, and we don't fully understand what that is. But I think I'll show you some data in a minute that shows that this is simply a function of the resolution of the analysis. Even though we're using 600,000 SNPs to try to detect these things, it's not good enough. It's not enough SNPs to be able to find where these things are in the genome. Okay, those were not detected in Angus. So these two QTLs at 7 on 93 and 20 at 4 were not detected in Angus. But it turns out that we know that they exist in Angus. We know they create variation in Angus because this is an analysis that we published in 2012 where we analyzed data from the Angus Association, 3,570 bulls that we genotyped with the 50K assay, and the two largest effects on nearly every trait in Angus are detected at chromosome 7 at 93 megabases and chromosome 20 at 4 megabases. So we know that they're in Angus. We did not detect them in the Angus composite animals that we used in the analysis, but they truly are there in Angus. And the reason, I think, is resolution. And so I'll show you some data that support that. So we're interested in finding these things, and we're interested in finding them within the breeds of which we detect that they segregate. Inside mapping, which is go back and individually genotype lots of SNPs and spend more money genotyping, trying to finely dissect each region of each chromosome to find the cause of mutation. We're doing something a little bit different. And this is actually really cool because it's free. It's nearly free. And here's how it works. So this is EXT. EXT has a genome that's represented by these two chromosomes. Every chromosome comes with one that was inherited from mom, the other one from dad. And about every 200 to 300 bases down that chromosome, there's a point that's variable within Angus. So we get a little bit worried about inbreeding in cattle, and we get a little bit worried that we're losing diversity in cattle. One of the things that we found by sequencing a lot of cattle is, in fact, they have more variability in their genome than humans do. And that's pretty surprising, isn't it? They have more variable points in their genome than humans do, even though the effective population sizes are indeed shrinking. And what that means is, as they've gone through that bottleneck when we domesticated them, and again when we formed breeds, and now that we're selecting them intensely, what we're actually losing is some of the haplotypes that Dorian was talking about, but we're not yet losing all of the diversity that exists within cattle. They have more variable points in their genome than we do. So what we've done is we've genotyped them with this 50K assay, and that's the little red bar. So about every 50,000 bases, we actually put one on a genotyping assay called the Bovine SNP 50, and that's what we genotype. And it costs about $70 to genotype that thing, and we get 50,000 points in the genome. But wouldn't that be great if we could get everything? So the question that has started to be posed by researchers doing this work around the world is, well, can we estimate it? If we've got this data here, can we use these data and the fact that we've now sequenced over 1,200 bulls and we've got genome sequence data on 1,200 bulls, can we actually estimate the entire genome on these animals? And so people are looking at different tools that can be used to go from 50,000 SNPs in the genome up to full genome sequence. So using just these statistical tools. And so we tried this with our Angus population. This is 3,570 registered Angus bulls that we genotyped with the 50K assay. And we wanted to know if we could go from 50K to whole genome sequence using the 1,000 bull project data. All of the genome sequence variant calls made in 1,147 bulls. And the answer is yes, you can. And yes, you can do it with remarkable accuracy. What this here is the best way of doing it, and that's to do it in two separate steps. So first, we've got a whole bunch of animals that we've genotyped with the 800K chip. So we first go from 50K to 800K, and then we go from 800K up to 35 million variants using another tool called FimpuGen. And this plateaus up here at about 88%. So we can get the genotypes predicted with about an 88% accuracy for free using existing data that we've got around the world. And this accuracy will only increase as we get more animals that are genotyped with higher density assays than the 50K. So if you start with the 800K, this can go up to about 95% accuracy, which is remarkable because these chips we're using, you know, have accuracies of about 99 to 99.5%, and it looks as though it's going to be possible to get potentially up to the 90-95% accuracy for the whole genome sequence of these individuals. And this just shows what we did to actually impute. We had 35.4 million variants in the 1,000 bull project data, and that just shows where they are on the chromosomes. And then we imputed them into those Angus bulls, and then we said, let's do the analysis, but we'll just take the ones that are at least at 5% frequency. So we'll take the ones that are reasonably common in the genome, and we'll analyze our data with that. And that's another Manhattan plot. This Manhattan plot, instead of having 50,000 points in the genome, actually has 9.4 million points in the genome. And I guarantee you that some of the variants that directly cause these really big QTL effects, this happens to be mature height, but it doesn't really matter. Some of the variants that are in the genome that really are underlying and causing these effects are in the data set. We've imputed them into the data set, and the question now is going to be, how do we prove that we've got the causal variants? And the way to do that is going to be to analyze multiple breeds and to use different genotyping tools that have some higher accuracies associated with them. I'll tell you about that in a minute. So here's that one on chromosome 7. This is jumping back to that QTL that underlies everything that's associated with size. It actually impacts everything that's size related. It hits stature, it hits weights, every weight that you record in Angus animals, and it pops up in all kinds of different breeds. So it segregates in multiple breeds. That's the signal for it on chromosome 7 using 400,000 imputed SNPs on that chromosome. So 95 is 4 million bases in the genome represented in there, and there are 12,000 variable SNPs now in that region of the genome. You observe something interesting. You observe this big cliff that occurs right here. The signal is highest right here, fall off a cliff right there. That means the genome assembly is wrong right there. Our reference assembly has an error in it right there. So we're only now starting to understand the extent to which the reference assembly, you know, we sequenced the cow in 2009 and we published it. And there have been a couple of attempts to try to rebuild it and improve it. We believe that 40% of the genes in the reference assembly are misassembled. So we've got evidence that we're trying to publish right now that shows that about 40% of the genes are just incorrectly assembled. We've got to do something to fix that. So Alexi Zimmern at Maryland is working to do that with data primarily produced by Tim Smith and the group at Clay Center using a brand new sequencing technology called Pacific Biosciences that gives us nice big long sequence reads. So that's happening right now. So this is the region that is the peak signal, and it turns out if you go look at the reference assembly, it says there are two genes in that region of the genome. There's one right there, there's one right there. The peak signal turns out to be right in between them. And we don't know if that's because we're really just dealing with markers that have 88% accuracy. So that could mean it could move around a little bit. Or is it because what's causing this effect actually isn't in a gene? It's something close to a gene that regulates how that gene works. And interestingly enough, this gene right here is something called arrestin-3, and we know it's a master regulator of growth in nearly all species. So it influences growth rates in mice and rats and humans and everything. So probably that's the gene, but what's the causal variant? Well, that's what we have to find out. We now have the tools to be able to do this. Dorian mentioned the Angus Association has 120,000 animals that have been genotyped with these high-density chips, these 50K chips. Well, what if we did this analysis not with 3,000 Angus bulls, but with 120,000? So no cost other than computer cost, and as Dorian has already pointed out, that's pretty cheap. Grad students are pretty cheap. Take those data, impute them up to full sequence, and now do an analysis that has 15 or 20 million SNPs in it in 120,000 animals, and let's have a look and see what that looks like. And what would happen if we did this, and because there's 25,000 or 30,000 more data points in Simmental, and if we do it with Red Angus, and if we do it with Charolais and Limousine, if we do this analysis and detect where all of these things are segregating and say which one of these looks like it's having the effect in all of those breeds. I argue if you do that, we ought to be able to find a lot of these things quickly. And if we can find them, we can put them on the low-density chips. If we can get them all on the low-density chips, we'll be able to improve dramatically the accuracies of the EPDs that are being delivered to you. Plus, we'll be able to do that for traits like feed efficiency, because we know what the effects of these are on growth and feed efficiency in the different breeds of animals. So that's the direction we're going on that. Just wanted to show you one more, because this is a ton of fun. My lab's now having a lot of fun imputing up the full genome sequence and seeing what we see when we do that. This is another one that Mark Enns is actually talking about, this project. This is respiratory disease. So we have another project looking at the genetics of susceptibility to respiratory disease in dairy cattle and in beef cattle. And what this shows is the very first analysis that we published, this came out I think earlier this year, where we had 2,000 Holsteins near enough. 1,000 of them were cases, 1,000 of them were controls. They were all raised in a single calf rearing facility out in California. 80,000 calves raised simultaneously in a calf rearing facility. We went through, we identified cases using the McGuirk scoring system. So you've got to take rectal temperatures, you've got to look at their nasal discharges, you've got to look at whether their nose is discharging, you've got to look at their eyes, measure that on all of these animals, and then follow in time, because the animals that you call controls that aren't sick, some of them get sick. And you've got to make sure that if they get sick, you correctly identify them. We did all of that. Every one of these animals, we took swabs, nasal swabs, cultured them, and looked for what pathogens we could find in them. But in this analysis, we look to see, if you like, what's the heritability of respiratory disease in this group of Holsteins? 21% when we analyze the data using the HD, the bovine HD assay. We then imputed it up to 11.6 million SNPs using the 1,000 bull data set, reran the analysis, heritability jumped to 23%. So a little bit of missing heritability. We're finding more genetic variation when we increase the resolution at which we do the analysis. And one thing that really turned out to be important was, if you have a look here, the whole genome that underlies respiratory disease susceptibility in those Holstein calves, it happens to be in a gene called poliovirus receptor ligand 1. And it's a gene that is known to mediate viral movement into cells. We were really excited to find that. But look what happens in this analysis down there. In this analysis here, the largest effect in the genome is down here on chromosome 27. There it is in this analysis. It's there. It's not quite the most statistical. It doesn't quite get above this threshold here to be genome-wide significant. But down here, look, screaming significance. And so resolution is important. Even when you do these studies with 800,000 SNPs, you miss stuff. You miss stuff because of patterns of linkage disequilibrium association within the genome. So we found it down here. It happens to be in a gene called FAT1, which is an immune function gene. No big surprise. And the question is, have we identified the causal variant? Well, we don't know yet. But we're repeating these analyses in now two cohorts of beef cattle, three cohorts of beef cattle that have been sampled from different regions around the country. And hopefully these things will turn up there too. So I think finding the causal variation is going to be really important. I think it's going to be really important because for traits like feed efficiency, it's going to be very difficult, and disease resistance, it's going to be very difficult to continually keep collecting these phenotypes. They're expensive. And I know some of the breed associations are doing it and able to do it. A number of them are not. And if you happen to be a breed association that's not collecting these data, how do you use this technology? You can't use this technology. But if we identify the variants that directly underlie susceptibility to the pathogens that cause respiratory disease, or the variants that underlie dry matter intake and that underlie feed efficiency, you can now use this technology. So it's very important that we move fast towards doing this. And I think this is the right approach. And we're doing two things. So we're doing a lot of this whole genome sequence imputation. We're actually now doing that in all of the feed efficiency animals. So that's currently underway. I've got a couple of students analyzing those data as we speak. And the last thing we're doing is we're a little bit concerned about the accuracy. So if we really can only do it with an accuracy of about 80 to 90%, that may cause us problems in truly identifying the causal variants in the genome. So what can we do to fix that? Well, one of the things that we can do to fix that is build a new genotyping assay and put on that that you think are likely to have functional effects. And that assay is currently being built, and I'm going to tell you a bit more about it in the next part of the talk, because it's actually primarily being supported by the Heifer Fertility Project. But we're, because I'm working on the BRD project, I'm working on the Feed Efficiency Project, I'm working on the Heifer Fertility Project, we're actually able to pool funds from all of those grants to enable building this new assay. And the new assay I'll show you about in just a minute. So let me tell you about the second project. This project is the Heifer Fertility Project, and it was originally written like this to have that word in the title, and some of the breed associations got a little upset when this got funded, and they said, what are you doing taking all this money from the government and just trying to benefit Angus and not help us? And I said, well, it had that in the title because the data that we had that supported writing this grant in the first place came from Angus. And so if you write a grant that says, I've got data in Angus and it shows we can do this, and I think it'll work too in Herefords and Simmental and Limousines, the people that fund these are the scientists, look at that and say, oh, ding, we're not going to fund you because you only think it's going to work. But we intended, fully intended, to actually work with multiple different breeds. And we were able to do that primarily because a number of the breed associations came in and co-sponsored this project, put another $250,000 into this project to help us get bull sequence that represented their breeds. And there the breed associations, international associations, stepped up and put money in. But I'm very grateful that we ended up with help from these breed associations to generate the data that we're using in this study and that are all about to be put into the public domain. We also had to work with the Missouri Show Me Select Replacement Heifer Program, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. Circle A Ranch has been very helpful, giving us access to all of their animals and DNA samples. So what's the idea here? So the idea here is that when we select cattle, it's a pretty simple concept, really. You look at the EPDs, you find the ones you like the best, and then you use those bulls to produce multiple progeny. And those progeny are going to be better than the ones that would have arisen had you not used those good bulls, if you'd just been random mating or if you'd used different bulls. So when you do that, the idea is we're propagating good genes throughout generations. Simple idea. We identify the animals that have the best genes, we propagate them through generations. The bad news is, and that results in this, that results in genetic improvement. The bad news is, and I call them defects, people call them different things. Every bull has got broken genes. Everyone sitting in this room has got broken genes in their genome. That is mutations that occurred at some point in history that resulted in that gene not producing the protein that it's supposed to produce. And when we look at bulls that we've sequenced, we will often see bulls that have up to 100 genes in their genome that are broken. That sounds remarkably large, doesn't it? But it's not, because not all of them actually cause observable effects. So we often see bulls that have two copies of a gene that's broken. Bull like EXT that has about nearly 100,000 registered progeny, I think, within the breed. So you can break genes and not pay much of a price. I think you do pay a price. I think that's why when we create crosses between breeds, we see hybrid vigor. The crossbred calves do better than the purebred calves because you're putting two sets of genes together where the ones that are broken tend to be different within the different breeds. But we see lots of them. Most of them don't do anything, but you know that some of them do, right? Some of them cause nasty things like hydrocephalus, dwarfism, curly calf, you know, things that are undesirable. And it's just natural. What you are going to get is broken genes propagated every generation that you use certain bulls heavily in a population. What you can't predict is what those genes are going to be, because all of these bulls carry different broken genes. So you will have different broken genes. It's just a part of a breeding program that we need to figure out how to manage. And so what we decided was that some of these are invariably going to be associated with early embryonic development problems and early embryonic loss. And there are data around, and Dave Nichols was talking to me about this yesterday, and Dave Nichols told me, you know, when they started making crossbred cattle on his ranch, and he started comparing the pregnancy rates and fertility and calving rates, he was seeing about a 5% superiority in the crossbred animals to the purebred animals. And that's entirely consistent with the idea that probably 5% of these pregnancies are getting lost early in development because two alleles get together in that little embryo that happen to be broken in a gene that's essential for life. And we know that there's about 2,800 genes that are essential for life, because we've knocked them out in mice and they all die. And the other ones you knock out, die. So there is about 5% to 10%, 10% of all the genes in the genome, you've got to have them. They've got to function. At least one of them has to function. And if you have two that don't function, you're not alive, you're dead. And in general, that happens at early embryonic development. So our concept is, let's find all of these things. Let's go look for these things. How do you find them? You sequence a lot of animals. How do you tell the ones that are early embryonic development ones, well, you genotype a lot of animals and see which ones never turn up in two copies. If an animal is alive and it doesn't have two copies of a broken gene, and you genotype enough animals, you can conclude it's a fertility allele. And that was what this grant was written to do. And we found, at that point, the time that we wrote this grant, I told you we had preliminary data, and it was in Angus. We sequenced 11 Angus bulls. We looked at all of the variants that we found in the genome of the bulls, and there was a lot of them. There was 126,000 variants that we detected that had an impact on the gene, that changed an amino acid in a protein. But we found 10,000 that looked like they probably resulted in broken genes, broken copies of genes floating around in that population. And of those, these are the ones that occurred in genes that are essential for life. So these are things that could potentially, certainly the loss of function ones, these ones down here, probably are lethals. And some of these are also probably lethals. And so the idea was, if we sequenced enough animals from enough different breeds, we'd be able to identify these things, build a genotyping chip, and then come back and genotype 10,000 Angus heifers. We've got to do that part within Angus because they're panmictic. You've got to have equal chance of the allele coming from mum as it does from dad. So that was the basic concept of this particular grant. So the idea was to sequence 100 bulls. We wrote in there that we'd sequence 100 Angus bulls, but then we came back and worked with the breed associations to actually get matching funds and come back and broaden that so that we could sequence bulls from lots of different breeds. Genotype 10,000 Angus heifers and just ask if we had a 1% frequency of these alleles. You'd expect to see one homozygote. If you have a 2, 3, or 4% frequency of these alleles, you'd expect to see a lot of homozygotes. And if you never see a homozygote, it means this thing's bad. It's a problem. It's causing problems and probably early developmental losses or those calves that get born and just disappear somewhere. Right? That's what these things are doing. So the idea is to find the variants, build an assay, genotype a lot of animals, find the ones that never turn up as two copies, and then start working against those, to select those out of the population. You can also compute MBVs for these things. If you genotype cattle and you know which ones carry which alleles, you can compute a fertility breeding value for that individual just based upon those individual variants, so we can do that. But now life gets complicated, because what if we find 5 or 6 of these things? You know, breeders are used to working maybe with 1 or 2 of these at a time, and that's not so bad, right? You can identify who the carriers are, make sure you never mate a carrier to another carrier, test the progeny if there was a carrier in the pedigree, and then you can figure out how to manage that. But what if we end up finding 20 of these things? How the heck do you do that? You need software. You need computer software to help you manage that, to actually say, here's the genotype of your cows, here's the genotype of the bulls you want to use, here's how you should breed them together to minimize the transmission of these alleles coming through into two copies in the progeny. So maximize the fertility of the matings by identifying where these broken alleles are. And this work's also being done by Brian Kinghorn, Alison Van Inenham, is working on that part of the project too. My part of the project is this bit of the project right up here. So this kind of shows you where we're at. 257 animals sequenced. We didn't do all of that in Missouri, but we've done a lot of that. We've done most of that at Missouri. The Red Angus data came from our friends in Canada. We did some horse trading. So we sequenced some Black Angus, they sequenced some Red Angus. We said, let's swap data. So we saved money by trading data with different groups. But the breed associations put funding in too so that we could get a lot of sequence. We got a few funny things floating around down here that came from other projects that we'd been working on for chip building with companies like Illumina. And there's actually 3 bison down there, and I won't talk about those today. But we sequenced 3 bison as well. So we also have been doing a lot of sequencing of the transcripts that occur in the tissues of different animals. So feed efficiency project, we've been looking at liver samples and a lot of other different brain parts and small intestine, and saying what genes are getting turned on and off in efficient animals versus inefficient animals. And in total, we've actually sequenced 153 more animals just for the bits that get made by genes, the protein coding part. And that's only about two. We're building this assay right now. This assay will be designed by the end of the month. So we started off saying we thought we'd be able to find 2,000 to 3,000 possible candidates for these fertility-related mutations, and we wanted to genotype those in these 10,000 heifers. And then lo and behold, we have all of these feed efficiency QTLs in all of these feed efficiency animals, and we said, well, we need to genotype a lot of mutations in genes that are around these QTLs, and the same thing in the BRD project. So why don't we just do it all together, put our money together, and do it all in one assay? And that's exactly what's happened. And so we're working right now with GeneSeq to build this assay. This assay is going to have 250,000 variants on it, and a lot of them are going to be amino acid changes, loss of function alleles. There's a lot of different classes here, which I'm not going to try to explain, but these are all things that we believe are likely to have functional effects. So everything that changes the way a protein is produced, so it changes an amino acid within a protein, is going to end up on this assay. So every single one of them that we have found today is going to end up on this assay. We're also going to have SNPs on it that are from the current genotyping products. So if you use the LD product, or if you use the 50K product, or the 800K product, which we have in a lot of these feed efficiency animals, we need to be able to impute genotypes up to those particular levels, because we want to use this to genotype new animals in the feed efficiency project. I told you we had at least 3,000 animals that have not been genotyped. We want to genotype them. And we want to be able to recapture the 50K genotype. So we have to put about 36,000 for imputation on there. And that's going to leave us about 190,000 that are possibly functional variants that we can design onto that thing. That assay will be built starting in July. It ought to be ready by September. We are buying 17,500 of these from GeneSeq. And I'm about to write some emails to other collaborative groups around the world to let them know that this is getting built, and that we may have the opportunity to even put some other content on there if you're interested. But if those other groups would like to use this assay, it will be available at the same time as the GeneSeq about that. But this thing will, by definition, have a lot of causal variants on it. So anything that causes loss of function, anything that changes amino acids in genes that are predicted to not be tolerated, are really good candidates for underlying the QTLs that we're trying to discover. And we're going to genotype 17,500 animals with that particular assay. Here's the 10,000 Angus heifers. Boy, this was fun. I don't know, you know, I'm not GeneSeq. GeneSeq people just send them stuff through the mail. I don't know if you've ever been to GeneSeq, but it's worth going in and having a look. They have not gotten rid of a sample since they opened the door. They're currently genotyping over 1 million samples per year, and they've got every single one of them still stored there. This was us running around the Midwest to Angus breeders in the Midwest sampling heifers. And we did this through the Show Me Select, primarily through the Show Me Select program that Dave Patterson runs at the University of Missouri. So we have tail hair pulls now on 10,251 heifers. We have a lot of data on these heifers. So a lot of these heifers, we have things like reproductive tract scores, we have birth weights, we'll actually follow them, and we'll collect phenotypic data on reproduction as these animals go on, and we will genotype them for 250,000 putatively functional variants, and look for the ones that never turn up in two copies. And use those data to also do things like build molecular breeding values for fertility or for puberty, age of puberty. So there'll be a lot of double use of these data. These animals will all be genotyped September, October. We'll have these data back. These are all on hair cards, and we'll send those hair cards off to GeneSeq, and they'll do the genotyping for us. So, how are we doing all of this? We didn't have the money to generate a new assay with 250,000 bead types on it and genotype 17,500 animals. So we did a lot of horse trading. So we put together those three grants that I told you about. I then went back and wrote a new grant that got funded this April. It was only $500,000, but it puts another $500,000 into the genotyping process. And on that grant, I said, we're going to build this assay. We're going to build this 200,000 functional variant assay. We're going to make it publicly available. We're going to put all of the sequence, the manifest, everything into the public domain. Anyone that wants to use it can go ahead and use it and just talk to GeneSeq about getting your samples genotyped. So we're going to do 10,000 Angus heifers as part of the heifer fertility project. We're going to do back 5,500 of the feed efficiency animals. So we've got 3,000 new animals to do. We'll do about 2,500 of the existing samples. We'll regenotype them across the different breed groups so that we'll end up with something in the vicinity of now 10,000 animals genotyped for a 50K and this functional product. And I think that's, and then we'll impute the full genome sequence. And the things that we think are functional, or at least these ones, will be genotyped with about a 99.9% accuracy. Very high accuracy. It'll help us with our imputation accuracy. We're going to do those 2,000 Holsteins that I showed you from the BRD project with this so that we can drill in on some of those QTLs that underlie susceptibility to the pathogens that are causing respiratory disease. And as I said, everything's going into the public domain, so that's not as trivial a thing as you might think. Getting things like sequence, whole genome sequence data, deposited into the NCBI databases is a real pain in the butt. It can take you a long amount of time to get that done, and so we've been doing that fairly slowly. But everything else that people are going to need to use this assay will be available through GeneSeq. It's all going to GeneSeq. So thank you for your attention, and if you've got any questions, Dorian will be happy to answer them for you.